Hello and welcome to Coffee House Shots, the Spectator's political podcast. I'm Lara Prendergast and I'm joined by James Forsyth and Katie Balls. James, over the weekend, the Oxfam scandal story seems to have heated up. Where are we now at?
I mean, this is very serious for Oxfam because obviously it's not only the events that happened that are truly appalling. It's about there appears to have been some sort of cover-up and Oxfam doesn't appear to have been straight in terms of what it said. You know, it said it told the Charity Commission about this. The Charity Commission says, no, you didn't tell us quite how bad this was. They used the word misconduct to cover up very serious things. And I think the scandal is... Sometimes you have these scandals where you know that there is more going to come out about other organisations in the same field. And I mean, there is a sense that some of these organisations working in these places have not kept as good an eye on their staff as they should have done. And when they've come across embarrassing, appalling acts, they haven't wanted to fully disclose them in public for fear it would affect their fundraising. And I think that does create big moral problems.
Katie, Priti Patel was talking about this yesterday, and Oxfam officials are meeting Penny Mordaunt today. What's going to be discussed, do you think?
Well, I think the big question is, does Oxfam still receive public funding? And we saw Penny Mordaunt on the Mars show suggesting that, you know, if it does seem like this is endemic, if it does seem like they kept information on purpose so as to keep funding and didn't tell the truth, or, you know, only told the slight truth, then it is hard to see how they would continue having public funding. Then you have another problem because, as we saw in the weekend papers, it's not just Oxfam. It seems to be a problem across different charities. Oxfam is particularly bad, partly because there doesn't seem to be a big cover-up. But Christian Aid, the Red Cross, Save the Children, they all have cases like this too. So you get to the point where I think if the government is still going to be doing international aid, it does have to use some of these organisations. So how are they going to approach this, and how are they going to make sure that it's the best way possible?
Katie, the papers also brought details of these roadmap to Brexit speeches. What are these going to be?
Yeah, so this is Theresa May's roadmap to Brexit, and it comes after weeks of lots of people, including us on this podcast, saying the government aren't really doing enough on Brexit or setting out a vision. It's a series of speeches. It kicks off on Wednesday with Boris Johnson in a Valentine's Day treat. He is going to be telling, I think his speech is on a United Kingdom, so it's reaching out to Remain voters or Brexit voters who are, you know, to basically get everyone on board with the vision and really spell out liberal conservatism. So the idea that, you know, your values will be reflected in Brexit Britain is not, you know, pulling up the drawbridge and so forth. There's an interesting point, I think, which is there are lots of speeches coming after that, which is not clear they all came up at the same time. It seems maybe Number 10 wanted to surround Boris's speeches with their own speeches. On Saturday, we have Theresa May giving a security speech in Munich, where she's going to basically say she wants closer ties with the EU after. That's slightly more thorny because it includes a European arrest warrant, which includes the ECJ jurisdiction. Then we have three more speeches next week, and then we have all leading to one big speech by the Prime Minister, final one, where hopefully she really lays out Brexit vision in a lot more detail.
James, what will you be looking out for in these speeches?
I think the Boris Johnson speech, I think Number 10 have learnt the hard way, but you can't really stop Boris Johnson giving a speech. Last time they tried to stop him and it ended up in 4,000 words on the front of the Daily Telegraph. I think the big question with Boris's speech, it is designed to reach out. And obviously, kind of hardcore kind of Remainers on social media are not going to like it. Opposition politicians aren't going to like it. I think the thing to watch for with Boris is we have a Conservative, particularly Conservative MPs, but also more broadly Conservative voters who voted Remain, whether they accept the olive branch or not, whether they are prepared to kind of give Boris a hearing or not. I think when it comes down to the nature of the deal, I mean, there are kind of two questions, which is, if you talk, I was talking in the post on Coffee House in my column on The Sun on Saturday about what the kind of compromise that people in the Brexit in the cabinet, where they think they're heading, which is high alignment on goods, particularly manufactured goods, kind of lower level alignment on agriculture and other goods like that, and then freedom on services. What you could term, if you were trying to be crude, you know, Norway for goods, Canada for services. A kind of fusion of EEA minus and CETA plus plus. So I think if you look at that, my question is, can she get that through the Brexit in the cabinet? And how does the EU respond to that? Because to date, the EU have suggested that they wouldn't like that because it's cherry-picking, or as we know, the more sophisticated people amongst us always tell us, we should call it raisin-picking, which is what the Germans call it, whether they would accept that or not. Now, you come back to the same argument, which is, on goods. They have, particularly manufactured goods, they have a big trade surplus with the UK, so surely they should be prepared to accept something that makes it easy for them to carry on selling goods into the UK market. We wait and see whether that happens or not, because where the Brexit inner cabinet, it's been hard enough getting them to agree an opening position, getting them to agree what the UK was prepared to barter away later on would be even more difficult.
Okay, she's finally, Parliament's in recess, but Theresa May is in Belfast today. Do we know what she's due to be talking about?
Yep, so I think she has a few technical reasons for her visit, but the big takeaway, what everyone is taking away from the fact she is flying there, is that we are close to breaking the deadlock at Stormont, and that's been going on for over a year, since January 2017. And there have been hints that, you know, from both the DUP and Sinn Féin that something could be about to happen. It's thought to be helped by the fact that Gerry Adams has now stepped down in that role. There is a new Sinn Féin leader at Stormont, but obviously you are seeing comments, I think, from DUP figures to saying, you know, we're making progress, but we're not quite there yet. And I don't know about anyone else, but when I see those words, I remember those words in terms of, you know, the phase one Brexit talks when the DUP stopped them and Theresa May had to fly back and basically try and convince the DUP to sign off on her deal. And we had a lot of, you know, making progress, but it went on and on and on. So I think although it does seem close when you are dealing, this is a kind of two groups that don't mind missing deadlines.
It's also obviously intimately connected with Brexit, in that if you look at this, one of the ways round this whole Irish border problem is the idea you devolve a whole bunch of stuff down to the Northern Ireland Assembly, and then the Northern Ireland Assembly decides to align itself with EU rules, and that would make things a lot easier in terms of the Irish border. But it's quite hard to say that that's the solution when you haven't got a functioning assembly in Northern Ireland.
Thank you, James. Thank you, Katie. And just a reminder that we've got a special subscription offer. You can get 12 issues for just £12, as well as a limited edition Spectator moleskin notebook if you go to spectator.co.uk/pod offer.